I call this meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting remotely under House Rule 10.01. We will start with the roll to figure out who's here. Anna, please go ahead.
Chair Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Scott. Representative Scott, present. Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hurt. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long. Representative Mortensen, excused. Representative Novotny.
Novotny, present.
Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
And Representative Zhang.
All right, thank you. We do have a quorum present. First, we'll need to approve the minutes of March 4th. That was just yesterday. Representative Vang, would you move the minutes for March 4th?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Vang moves approval of the minutes for March 4th, 2021. Any discussion to the minutes? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the minutes are approved for March 4th, 2021. First up on the agenda today, we had to move things around a little bit, but we're gonna go to Representative Morrison first with House File 801. Just to remind folks, the sections relevant to our committee's jurisdiction are in sections 7 and 8, and that was included in the notice if you need to check. Representative Morrison, I will move your bill. I will move that House File 801 be recommended to be referred to the State Government Finance Committee. So your bill is now before us. Please tell us about your bill, Representative Morrison.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 801, which would establish a prescription drug affordability board to give the state the ability to limit how much Minnesotans pay for certain high-cost drugs. I want to give a brief overview of the authority of the Prescription Drug Affordability Board and the need for the board. I'll focus my comments on the provisions as the chair referenced in section 7 and 8 that this committee has jurisdiction over. The Office of the Attorney General's, is also here to speak to these provisions if there are questions. The cost of prescription drugs continue to skyrocket in the United States, making it difficult for Minnesotans to afford their prescriptions. Unless we do more to keep costs down, more people will not be able to afford their drugs, leading to poorer health outcomes and higher healthcare costs. This legislation is based on a National Academy of State policy model. At least 6 other states have implemented prescription drug affordability review initiatives, including Maryland, Maine, New Hampshire, New York, Massachusetts, and Ohio. By addressing the high costs of drugs, we could lower the high cost of healthcare and health insurance. This proposal was one of the top strategies of the Blue Ribbon Commission charged with finding saving in the state budget. Let me give you just a few examples of recent skyrocketing drug prices. The cost of Bavencio, a new cancer drug approved several years ago, is about $150,000 a year per patient. A new muscular dystrophy drug came on the market for an eye-popping price of $300,000 annually. In 2016, the FDA approved a new bladder cancer treatment that costs $12,500 a month or $150,000 a year. Even older drugs that have been on the market are not immune. The cost of insulin has tripled between 2002 and 2013, despite no notable changes in the formulation. And the 4-decade-old EpiPen, a life-saving allergy medication, has seen a price hike of 500% since 2007. Clearly, more must be done to rein in the high cost of medications. The commission is an independent body that evaluates drug prices and sets an upper payment limit if a drug's price is excessive and prevents an affordability challenge for the state's health system or patients. The payment limit applies throughout the state healthcare system to protect consumers, state and local governments, health plan companies, providers, pharmacies, and others. The overarching goal of a prescription drug affordability board is to find the upper payment limit at which insurers, purchasers, and government programs can afford to provide the drug to everyone in the state who should get it, who needs it. The point of an upper payment limit is to expand sales and patient access, not to reduce manufacturer revenue. The bill establishes a commission whose members have relevant experience and are without conflicts of interest and are appointed by the governor and the majority and minority leads in the Senate and House. The bill also establishes a 12-member advisory council to provide advice to the commission and is made up of stakeholders, including drug manufacturers, employers, health plan and company providers, researchers, advocates, and state government. Not all drugs would be reviewed by the Affordability Board, just those that meet certain price or price increase thresholds using data from the new transparency law and publicly available national and international pricing data. There's no new reporting requirements for drug manufacturers. It also requires the Commissioner of Health to notify the board within 30 days of any increases in drug price above the threshold set in law for brand name, generic, biosimilar, and biologic drugs. As stated in Section 7 of the bill, the information related to drug cost review shall be available to the public, with the exception of information that is likely to compromise the financial or competitive position of the drug manufacturer or information that would qualify as a trade secret. Section 8 allows for the Office of the Attorney General to enforce and pursue remedies if it finds that an entity was noncompliant with the commission reimbursement requirements. In addition, there's an appeals process established in law so that any person affected by the decision of the commission may request an appeal within 30 days of the date of the decision. Finally, Section 11 is the severability clause that makes clear if any provision in the bill are held invalid by the courts, the remaining sections of law would go into effect. And the Attorney General's office, as I said, is here to ask questions. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Yep, I don't have anyone signed up to testify, but we'll note that there are a couple folks from the AG's office available if members do have questions. With that, we will move on to member questions. Any discussion, members? Representative Scott.
There we go. Thank you, Madam Chair. I moved my screen over and I couldn't get to my unmute button. Sorry about that, Madam Chair. Representative Morrison, I have kind of some of the same questions as I had with the price transparency bill from last year or the year before, whenever we passed that. And it has to do with who on the board would be qualified to determine if data and information that they have is or is not proprietary.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. The board will be made up of people who have expertise in these areas, and then also the board will also be advised by the council, who also will have expertise in healthcare economics and pharmacy.
Representative Scott.
And so one of the things I see as kind of missing in this bill is a definition of what's proprietary. There are different definitions in statute defining that word, and I think it would be beneficial to have a real definition of what's proprietary. And as with the transparency bill, I also have concerns when you're dealing with this proprietary information that a bunch of lawyers are going to get involved, and they're gonna talk about federal law and state law and which trumps what, because you know, these companies are gonna want to protect their trade secrets and their proprietary information. And I just don't want our state to get into, you know, a bunch of lawsuits, because then nobody gets helped by anything. So those are still the concerns that I have. I don't know if Representative Morrison wants to comment on those. So I'll leave it at that. Those are my concerns, Madam Chair.
Right. Thank you, Representative Scott. Any response, Representative Morrison?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. I appreciate your bringing up those points. You know, the bill draws on the law that we established last year with the drug price transparency law that established what was considered proprietary information. So there's nothing new established here. And the board will also use publicly available pricing data to determine upper payment limits if a drug is deemed excessively expensive.
Thank you. Did you have another question, Representative Scott?
I do, Madam Chair, because in the bill that we passed on the transparency issue, there was no definition for proprietary information. So in that bill. So this is still an issue, and it's defined elsewhere in statute. I don't know why it can't be put in statute, you know, in this bill going forward, so that the people on the board have a definition to work from. Thank you.
Thank you. I will note, I know in other bills we've had this year, you know, if you have too many cross-references and you put different, you know, additional language that isn't actually necessary in the bill, I know that our research staff have told us that that can create problems in and of itself as far as assumptions that judges may make later and what the intent was with the bill. But we have now have this this testimony on the record as far as our intent. With that, we'll move on to Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say thank you to Representative Morrison for bringing this bill forward again. I just wanted to share quickly that I think this is absolutely critical. I'm somebody who has a chronic condition I've been managing for since I was 16. Medication that I had taken for decades went from a copay of $10 each month, and for no apparent reason, decades later, it went up to $100 a month for a copay. And I think that, you know, for me, that adjustment, though it was difficult, I was able to do it. But for most people, that is the difference between somebody having food that month or not. And so I really appreciate that this bill is being brought forward. And I think it's a really good bill. And, you know, I just wanted to say thank you to Representative Morrison for continuing to bring this forward.
Thank you. With that, Representative Morrison, any closing words on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to present the Drug Price Affordability Board to committee this morning. I think we need to reshape how we approach the cost of prescription drugs. We need to see it as a public good, the public good that it is. I appreciate your consideration of this bill.
All right. Thank you. There were no amendments filed to this bill, so I will renew my motion that House File 801 be recommended to be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Rebecca Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Nope.
Representative Feist. Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel. Excused. Representative Hurt.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen, excused. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, no.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
And Representative Feist?
Aye.
Perfect. There are 10 ayes and 5 nays.
All right, thank you. With 10 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and House File 801 is on its way to the State Government Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Morrison. And with that, I will turn the gavel over to the other KMO, Vice Chair Kelly Moeller. I have to run to another committee, but I'll be back. So I am handing you the virtual gavel, Vice Chair Moeller.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And our next bill up is House File 167, Chair Stevenson's bill. Welcome to the committee, Chair Stevenson. And I will move that House File 167 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Finance and Policy Committee. We have the bill before us, and I believe, Chair Stevenson, that you have the A3 author's amendment. So I will go ahead and move the A3 amendment to put the bill in the shape the author desires. Do we have any discussion on the amendment? All right, seeing none, we'll move to a voice vote on adopting the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A3 amendment is adopted, and Chair Stevenson, please go ahead and tell us about your bill. I think you're muted.
Microphone wasn't turned on, I realized. It's my fault, sorry about that. I unplugged it to take it home last night and then forgot to hit the button to turn it back on when I got here. Well, House File 167, Madam Chair, members of the committee, has to do with pre-sentence investigations. And a pre-sentence investigation, just by way of reference, is a report that's prepared by probation in between when a defendant enters a plea or is found guilty at trial of an offense and as the name implies, before they are sentenced. Current law requires that pre-sentence investigation be completed in all felony matters. And the reason why I'm bringing this bill forward is I can tell you from my experience as a prosecutor that pre-sentence investigations aren't necessary in all felony matters. So let's talk a little bit first about what is a pre-sentence investigation. It's an extremely intensive, very helpful document. I like to think of it as a defendant's life story. It is usually, 6 to 8 pages long, single-spaced. It contains a ton of information about the defense early life, their education, their health. It might look at their substance abuse history if they have that. It might look at mental health considerations. It's going to look at a whole variety of factors that will really tell the defendant's story. And I mentioned that the document is very useful. And when there's a debate or a dispute or just some ambiguity about what type of sentence the defendant might have, this document is critical. So if you are having a situation where there might be a departure from our sentencing guidelines, either upward or downward, someone's going to potentially go to prison who otherwise would go to probation or might go to probation who otherwise would go to prison, this document is very important. But for a lot of cases, there's really no dispute about the disposition of the defendant, and particularly when we're thinking about our lower level offenses, felony offenses, our property and drug crimes, where we know that the defendant is going to be on probation and probably on, unsupervised probation or administrative probation. Generating an 8-page document that very few, if no one, will ever read is frankly wasteful of our state's resources and not a good use of probation's time and energies. So what this bill attempts to do is say, here's when we really need pre-sentence investigations for certain serious felonies like criminal sexual conduct cases. Also in cases where there's a motion for an upward or downward departure, really important there. But otherwise, it takes it from a shall to a may. And the last thing I'd say about it is that change from a shall to a may brings it in line with the rules of criminal procedure. And that, I think, is important to note because right now there's a conflict. The rules of criminal procedure say that the court may order a pre-sentence investigation, and the law says shall. And I will tell you from my own experience as a prosecutor, judges will frequently note that discrepancy and decide that the rules trump the law and that we don't need to do a pre-sentence investigation. So I think it would be good for us to have consistent law that really kind of clarifies when this document is necessary and doesn't overburden our great and skillful career probation officers.
All right, thank you so much. And I believe you do have a testifier. Is that correct,
Chair Stevenson? I believe that is correct, Madam Chair.
All right, great. So the testifier I have is Valerie Dorf. If you can please introduce yourself and you can begin your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dorf and I'm a field services agent out of the Moorhead Department of Corrections office. I've been employed as a probation and parole agent for 28 years and have worked for the state of Minnesota for the last 25 years. I'm here to testify in support of House File 167. The Moorhead Adult Felony Probation Office has 9 agents with caseloads ranging from 70 to 240 offenders per agent. Caseloads are divided by risk level, with higher risk offenders receiving more intensive supervision. In addition to supervising offenders in the community, DOC agents are also responsible for writing pre-sentence investigation reports or PSIs for all felony cases and some misdemeanor cases. A PSI begins with an interview of the offender, which follows conviction, but is before sentencing. This interview typically lasts between 1 and 2 hours. information gathered from the offender is written into a comprehensive social history type of report. The report includes many sections, such as personal history, education, employment, financial information, accommodations, leisure activities, chemical use, and physical and mental health. The PSI includes information about the offense, such as the defendant's version, the official version, and the plea agreement, if there is one. The PSI may incorporate other assessments, such as a substance use evaluation, a mental health assessment, or a psychosexual assessment. Probation agents reach out to victims and include their thoughts and concerns regarding the impact of the offense. Lastly, the PSI contains a final assessment, a review of Minnesota sentencing guidelines, and a recommendation for either a probationary sentence or a commitment to prison. A PSI is often 6 to 8 or even 10 pages long and takes an average of 4 to 6 hours to write, depending on the complexity of the case. Our goal is to use DOC resources as effectively as possible. Spending scarce resources to write PSIs on low-level felony offenses only serves to reduce time spent with offenders to ensure they are prepared to successfully reintegrate into the community. Adding discretionary language to the PSI statute won't fix the problem of truly overwhelming caseloads. Only more agents will do that. But after years of denied requests for additional agents in field services, our hope is that this bill will allow agents more time to actually work with offenders to affect the change we all wish to see. Please support House File 167.
Thank you. Well, I don't believe there are any other testifiers, so we will begin with member discussion. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I probably should have asked this before we passed the amendment, but to the bill's author, the amendment to me clouded a little bit the difference between court rules and statute. And maybe this is a question for House research, if the bill's author doesn't know. But prior to adding the amendment, it seemed like it was a fairly simple bill. You changed a shall to a may. And now we've kind of nuanced particular cases that are going to require a PSI. So how will the courts jive that, if you get what I'm going for here?
Chair Stevenson.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Scott, excellent question. A couple thoughts about that. Number one, the cases that are specifically delineated in the amendment as requiring them are the types of cases that a court is going to order a PSI regardless. Again, when there's going to be a departure, you know, that's specifically called out, a court's going to need a PSI to inform their decision making there. Looking at CSC cases, you're always going to want a PSI there. The other reason that's a good idea to put that in the statute is it clarifies things for the department and allows us to change the cost. So I don't know if this is probably more for the Public Safety Committee, but there was a fiscal note on this bill that had a cost because without a PSI in those CSC cases, probation is going to have to do exit interview work when CSC offenders who have to register depart custody. That's normally done in the connection of the PSI. So it's important to clarify it still needs to be done in those cases. Certainly, it becomes less simple as a result of the amendment, but I think it more directly clarifies when a PSI is actually necessary and when it isn't.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if someone from House Research could chime in on that too. Not that I don't trust Representative Stevenson, the bill's author, but I'd just like to hear from them what the courts would do in these situations. Would they need to change court rules or just leaving the statute and the rules with changing the shall to may? Is what's going to happen here?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Scott. And I know in past committees too, we've had this discussion about when there's, if there's a conflict between statute and rule, and if there's procedural or substantive, and which one controls. And I think it's a really good idea to have Mr. Johnson perhaps walk us through that.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Ben Johnson with House Research. We are dealing with a potential conflict between the statute and the rules. That conflict exists under current law, as Representative Stevenson indicated. The current statute requires the creation of a pre-sentence investigation in all felony cases. The court rule, which is Rule 27.03, makes it optional in all felony cases. The change in law here would make it optional in most felony cases, but leave a few cases in place. In general, the courts feel that they have the right to control all procedural matters, while the legislature has the right to control all substantive matters. I believe that the courts have determined that this is essentially a procedural matter, though I don't know that there's any official appellate case law reaching that decision. I'm not sure it's actually been challenged one way or the other at this point. Typically, the courts will respect the other branch to the extent possible, as long as they feel that there is no conflict. Exactly how each individual court will handle each individual case before it is something that I can't specifically comment on. Again, they will defer when they feel it's appropriate to the legislature and try to avoid finding a conflict between the statutes and the rules. I think that's all I can add at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. That was extremely helpful. And Representative Scott, do you have any other questions or comments?
No, thank you, Mr. Johnson, for that explanation. And so I guess the short answer is we just don't know for sure how they're going to interpret it and going forward. I do have just one other question. Is the amendment going to change the fiscal note? And then I'll hang up and listen, as they say on talk radio.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, it is my understanding it will change the fiscal note, and my strong hope is that it will obviate the need for any cost, but it should reduce the cost.
Thank you. I also see we have a question from Representative Johnson.
Chair Mueller, Representative, I just done looking up some information on this. The reason this current law goes back to 1978 when the Sentencing Guidelines Commission was enacted. The reason for that was to try to get rid of sentence disparities and require judges to do departure forms when it departed from the Sentencing Guidelines recommendations. The pre-sentence investigation was part of that. It was required to make sure that the sentence was in the guidelines of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, comparing the total points that the individual may have and placing it on the sentencing guidelines grid. It's unfortunate that the judges haven't been requiring this anymore. I think it was a good reason to have it, to make sure that that we get rid of our sentencing disparities. Both upward and downward departures are causing a lot of the disparities, and the reports have to be filed, but I'm gonna have to work on a bill to make sure that those reports are looked at and the reasons for the departures are valid. Sometimes it might be part of a plea bargain, but sometimes it's not. I would like to see pre-sentence investigations on all felonies, but I know that financial burdens, because probations have been left out of the funds for quite a few years, where they have costs going up, but what I'm hearing is 4%, but they're only getting 1% increase in their budgets. They are overworked and understaffed, so I would like the judges to actually do these, but they claim a separation of powers. So I understand it, but I think it's a good thing to do these pre-sentence investigations. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Just a reminder, my last name is pronounced Mueller. I know we have a member, Mueller, also, so it gets confusing.
I apologize for that.
No problem. Chair Stevenson, would you like to respond to that?
I would, because I think that it's important to clarify a couple things that Representative Johnson brought up that I think he maybe misunderstands the bill. He mentioned departure reports and wanting to make sure that the sentence was consistent with the guidelines. Well, this bill doesn't do anything with departure reports. Departure reports, when a judge departs from the sentencing guidelines upward or downward, they have to fill out a departure report form. The bill does nothing with that. In terms of making sure that the sentence conforms with the sentence guidelines, is on the grid in the correct place, the pre-sentence investigation does spell out, it includes generally what's called the sentencing worksheet, which is where we find out how many points you have and what the severity level of the offense is, and therefore where you are on the grid. But it doesn't have to include the sentencing worksheet. The sentencing worksheet can be completed independent of the pre-sentence investigation. Pre-sentence investigation, again, is that 6 to 8 page long narrative, the defendant's life story. So under the bill, judges would still, we would still have probation do the sentencing worksheet. We would still have, for every felony before sentencing, we would know how many points and what the severity level is of the offense. So we would know if we're where we are on the grid to make sure there aren't those disparities that Representative Johnson's discussing. What we wouldn't have in low level cases is a 6 to 8 page narrative describing all the detail that the testifier brought up about you know, what brought the defendant to this point in their life type discussion, which just isn't a good use of government resources on low-level felonies. So I just wanted to clarify that the report does nothing with departure report. The bill does nothing with departure reports, does nothing with the sentencing worksheets. It only is looking at PSIs.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Representative Johnson, did you have a follow-up question to that?
I'm gonna skip that right now.
Okay, Representative Scott.
I'm sorry, I had one more, just more of a comment. I noticed that in this amendment that it's going to require, to me, these are really serious felonies where they're gonna still require the PSI. And so I just wanted to note that on there is assault by strangulation. And if we go back to this veterans restorative justice bill, that is still in that bill. And it was serious enough of an issue to put in this amendment that I think it's worth pointing out that it should be excluded, excuse me, from that bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, well, that obviously, as you acknowledge, is a totally different bill from the discussion here. Chair Stevenson, did you have any final remarks to your bill?
This is a good bill. I hope everyone supports it.
Okay, with that, I renew my motion that House File 167, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
April is building. We can break the lease. And so we were going to do that. Ms. Kate.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead, Anna.
Ms. Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen, excused. Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Rodman. Sounds good.
Sorry, aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
And Representative Hollins. We have 14 ayes and no nays.
There being 14 ayes, House File 167, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy Committee. Seeing that Chair Becker Finn is back, I don't know if she's back for the rest of the committee, if she wants me to keep the gavel. Chair Becker Finn? That might, the no response might be the answer. So I'm gonna just go ahead and continue on here. Our next bill, members, is House File 1636 from Chair Bernardi. Let's see here. Chair Bernardi, I will move that House File 1636 be recommended to be re-referred to the Higher Education Committee. And I do see that you have an A1 author's amendment. So I will move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape you desire. Do we have any discussion as to the amendment? All right, seeing none, we'll move to a voice vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted, and welcome to the committee, Chair Bernardi. Go ahead and explain your bill to us.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. The bill in front of you is part of a larger policy package from the Office of Higher Education to improve programs and protections that serve residents and students of our state. I have a few staff from the agency who are here today to answer any questions you may have. This bill has two data provisions that are before your committee today. Host file 1636 refers to the Minnesota College Savings Plan. 529 plans are named after section, 529 of the Internal Revenue Code. Just one second, I'm having computer issues here. We'll get back, there we go. This code authorized the state to create a plan to allow people to save for higher education expenses in a tax-free way. The language before you would allow the office to share individual account owner data with the Department of Revenue, and then the Department of Revenue would return summary level data of account owners by income bands to the office. The summary data would allow the office to better understand its current account owners, and that will allow them to more effectively administer the plan. Research shows that even a small savings plan is better than none, as those with a savings plan have higher college going rates. Even with savings of less than $500, a child is 25% more likely to enroll in college and 64% more likely to graduate than a child who has no savings. This is according to a study done by Washington University. In the language that was amended to the bill, it relates to consumer protections. Over the past few years, we have seen a number of private institutions close. Most of them are for-profit private institutions. Most recently, Argosy University closed abruptly midterm, leaving a number of students in bad situations. Fortunately, through the action of the legislature, our local institutions, and the Office of Higher Education, we were able to help many of the students who were impacted. Additional protections were needed, and we passed a student consumer protection package. This package is some holdover language from that work. The Office of Higher Education worked closely with the private institutions to develop this risk analysis language. There are four subdivisions, and I'll just briefly tell you about the first three and then move into the part that is before this committee. Subdivision one identifies the triggers for the analysis. Subdivision two avoids a lag in the information they receive. And subdivision three outlines the process and actions the office can take. And the reason why this bill is before you is in subdivision four. Data classification. Data under this section shall be classified as financial records under section 136A.64, subdivision 2. This ensures the information collected from the institutions for this purpose, remains private. Thank you, committee members, and we stand for questions.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. And I do see that you do have a few testifiers, as you said, they're just available for questions. It's my understanding. And I don't know that we have anybody else signed up to testify. I don't believe that we do. So we'll go ahead to questions. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome to our committee. Representative Bernardi. I had a couple of questions, starting with the amendment that you added. I'm just wondering, is the data that you're speaking to in the amendment classified as private, confidential, or public data? It's not clear from the bill language or the cross-reference to 134A there. And if you don't know the answer to that question, perhaps House Research could help with that.
I will call on House Research for that. Thank you.
Okay, great. Mr. Hopkins, are you able to help us with that question?
Madam Chair and members, so the amendment in Subdivision 4 classifies these documents as financial records under a different higher ed statute. Under that higher ed statute, that's 136A.64 Subdivision 2, financial records aren't given a data practices classification per se. That subdivision just says that the office shall not disclose financial records except for the purposes of defending a decision to approve or not approve the granting of degrees or the use of a name by the school. So it's not technically a Chapter 13 classification, but broadly speaking, the financial records are kept private, so they're not publicly available.
That was very helpful, Mr. Hopkins. I learned something new about data privacy every day in this committee. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks, Mr. Hopkins, for that explanation. Going back to the body of the bill then, Representative Bernardi, what research and analysis will the Office of Higher Education and the Department of Revenue conduct to evaluate the account owner's plan in order to make ongoing informed decisions regarding the administration of the plan?
Chair Bernardi, or if you want to call on one of your testifiers.
Thank you. I will call on the Office of Higher Education to answer that question.
Okay, and I don't know who's here from...
I know we have Robert Helgeson as well as Nikki Oliver, so I'm not sure which one will answer that question.
So whoever wants to answer that question, if you could please just introduce yourself for the committee before you begin, and welcome to the committee.
Hi, Madam Chair. Hi, committee members. My name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the manager of Grants and Government Relations, and I will probably tap Robert Helgeson as he's the manager of the 529 plan. But essentially, the analysis done, we would send the account owner information to the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue will be able to band the income levels of the account of the users of the 529 plan, and they would send that summary data back to our agency. So, for example, they could possibly send back that less than 10% of those account owners have an income of $50,000. That would give us a sense of who we should be targeting with outreach in to utilize the 529 plans. As Representative Bernardi mentioned, we know that individuals being able to save for college drastically increases their college going rate and their retention rate. So that's essentially the type of summary level data we would want and analysis we would be getting from the Department of Revenue. And I don't know if Mr. Helgeson has anything to add, but.
Go ahead, Mr. Helgeson. Welcome to the committee and please introduce yourself. Mr. Helgeson, we can't hear you. We still are unable to hear you. It looks like we're having some technical problems. Why don't we, as you're working on that, why don't we go back to Representative Scott? Did you have any follow-up questions? Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I do. And if he gets back online, and feel free to go back to him. So my next question would be probably the same person could answer the question. Ms. Alger, I think, was the last name. So what data sets are going to be shared? And I understand it's going to be summary data. And so two things. what data sets will be shared, and will you be getting consent from the account owner before sharing the data?
Okay, Ms. Oliver, did you want to take that one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott. If you're referring to the data that our office would need to send to the Department of Revenue, we would need to send the information needed for them to identify whether or not that individual reported that they had a 529 plan on their tax information. So we would be able to send, I think, social security numbers, names and addresses to the Department of Revenue, and keep in mind that all that information would still remain private. It'd just be an agency to agency data sharing agreement, and we wouldn't be able to tie back to an individual their income levels, because like I said, what we would get back from the Department of Revenue would be summary level data, just a general broad like banded information about account users. And I think Mr. Helgeson has his sound on, so he can talk about the consent information and how the 529 plan already works.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Mr. Helgeson, do we want to try this again?
I wouldn't try. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Thank you. Sorry about the technology issues. I don't do a lot of Zoom meetings, and Teams meetings I'm very good at, but the Zoom meetings I'm still learning, so I apologize. My name is Robert Helgeson. My official title is the Audit Manager at the Office of Higher Education, and I also, one of my duties is the Contract Manager for the Minnesota College Savings Plan, so I am the primary contact that works with our third-party manager, which is Tuition Financing Incorporated, part of TIAA. They handle most of the day-to-day operations. The State Board of Investment and OHE outsource that contract to them to handle all the day-to-day operations, and they keep the accounting records and the individual account owner records for us and keep them up to date. So the information that we're looking at right now, we really don't know. We know some things about our account owners. Sometimes they voluntarily provide information via a survey. They'll indicate, where they, we have their address, of course, but they'll indicate what they do, what their age is as far as the account owners, those types of things. But what we don't know, and what is critical for us and for our third-party manager, is we want our the philosophy of a Minnesota plan is to encourage everyone to save for college, not just people who have a lot of income or a lot of wealth, but we're also encouraging those with low incomes, even if they set aside $25, $50 a year, to go along with what was stated earlier about if you have some college savings, it really does make a difference as to how you perceive post-secondary education and whether you will participate in post-secondary education. So our goal is to try to find out what are the demographics as far as income levels of our account owners. And so the information that is shared would be the account owner's basic information to be able to match with the Department of Revenue, which is going to be their Social Security number, and their name is about all they have to have. And then the Department of Revenue would match that information against the most recent year's state tax returns, pull the income level from there, and then provide us back summary level so that it would be impossible for us to figure out any individual's income level, because that's not what we don't want that. We just want to get a sense. So is 90% of our account owners make $150,000 or more, that tells us that we're not doing a very good job of reaching into the lower income ranges. And we want to make sure we're doing that, and we want to make sure we're targeting our marketing and getting into those places. So that's the information that would be shared. And as I said, we're getting back the summary data. and we will let the Department of Revenue band that such that it is impossible for us to identify any single individual's income, because that is none of our business. We readily admit that. As far as permission from the account owner, when they sign up to create an account, they do sign a privacy statement and then that statement indicates what they are agreeing to and what their information can be used for. Our intention would be to modify that so that it would include this particular usage. And for those who are existing account owners, we would send out an addendum or an update to them and ask them, and they could opt out if they wanted to, since they signed their privacy statement in some cases 18 years ago when they opened the account.
Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so quite a few things I learned from that, and just some comments going forward. I believe, and Representative Bernardi, I know you don't swim in this ocean over here very much with data stuff, but one of the things that we try to put in place when agencies are sharing data between the two is we put in audit trails and role-based access so that it protects the data going to and from. We can go back and see who accessed the data if they had a reason for doing so based on their job. And, you know, when you're talking about people's name and social security number being shared, I'm no IT person, but I understand the timing of when that information is most vulnerable is when it's being transferred. And so I have great concerns about that. And so there's a couple of additional things that I think this bill needs. I know you give some sort of permission when people open a 529 account, but there should be a separate box, not just I agreed to all of the above things when they open this account, but there should be a separate box that they would have to check agreeing that their information could be shared with the Department of Revenue. That is a big deal. People are very concerned about identity theft and that sort of thing. So I think that should be a separate box for them to check that they agree to have their information shared. And I think that there should be a deadline, you know, for the next 2 years after you get this data that you're needing, that you shouldn't need to collect it anymore. You'll have an idea of who is getting who you need to target. And so those are some of my comments with this bill. I have quite a few concerns because it is such sensitive data. And so I just wanted to share things maybe that could tighten the bill up a little bit, Madam Chair, and to the bill's author. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Chair Bernardi, did you have any follow-up comments to that?
That is good information, and let's keep in touch as we move forward to see if there's ways and we can address those issues.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Bernardi, for bringing this bill. I have several concerns, and so I don't know if the people from Department of Revenue or Office of Higher Ed wanted to respond, but the first is based on the statements Mr. Helgeson just provided, and the previous lady as well, there's this talk of the information that gets sent back is summary data or banded, but in the bill, it doesn't say anything about that. It just says that the account owner data may be used by the office in cooperation with the Department of Revenue for purposes of research and analysis to evaluate the plan to make ongoing informed decisions regarding administration of the plan. That's really broad, and it says nothing about summary data. So if you could point me to where you're talking about summary data, I would love to see it. Thank you.
Chair Bernardi, did you want to take that one?
No, actually, I will defer that to the Office of Higher Education. So Mr. Helgeson or Ms. Oliver.
Whichever one of you wants to take it, go right ahead.
This is Robert Helgeson. I agree that with the representative that there is no specific reference to summary data. We're talking about what OHE plans to do with it, and I think that's very good feedback that we could incorporate, that we would only receive summary data back from the department, because that's all we want. And as I mentioned before, we have no interest in knowing anybody's individual income. We're just looking at a broad picture. So the point is well taken, and I appreciate that.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thanks. Yes, thank you for that. My next question is about the testifier mentioned that this data is necessary for the third party managers. And again, that's not referenced in the bill, and there's no provisions for sharing with anyone outside the department. So could you address that issue as well and who your third party manager is?
Again, Mr. Helgeson or Ms. Oliver, either one of you.
Chair Moeller, representative, our third party manager is allowed under our Minnesota statutes 136G. That entire 136G refers to the Minnesota College Savings Plan, and under that statute, the State Board of Investment and the NOHE commissioner are charged with running the plan, but they are also allowed to contract with an external provider. Most states' 529 plans use an external manager. There are exceptions, but I would say about 95% of the state plans are run by external. And part of our contract with that, and our contract with Tuition Financing Incorporated, which is a subsidiary of TIA, one of the largest insurance companies and retirement providers in the country, if not the world, signs the contract with the state of Minnesota, and in there is laid out the concerns you have as far as privacy. They have to have the data to operate the plan on our behalf, but they are prohibited from selling that or selling names or doing any kind of cross-marketing for their other products. So that is incorporated into our contract with them.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. Thank you for that answer. I appreciate the clarification. And then finally, I did want to reference your about existing plan holders. You said they would be given an opt-out. So if you could just clarify that. My understanding is that you would want to be able to access their data and share, get it from the Department of Revenue, but they would have, so the default is that all that data of existing plan holders is shared unless they opt out. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Helgeson.
Chair Moeller, Representative Robbins. We've thought through this, and we understand this is very sensitive data, and we do communicate back and forth, and we use a secure system with TFI. We don't just float this through general email. So I want to assure you that we do take this extremely seriously. Because we have so many existing account owners and we don't want to catch them unawares, we're not trying to do a gotcha and just tell them we're going to start sharing their information. So we have to send out updates about the plan every time there's some sort of change, either in the privacy policy or in the plan itself. And when we communicate with the existing account owners, we would explain that here's what we want to do, but if you're uncomfortable with that, you can opt out of that, and we will not send your information to the Department of Revenue for matching, but we're going to explain why we want to do this and that we're not interested in their individual income levels. But no, we would not, it would not be a, hi, we're going to use all your data. We're going to tell them exactly what we want. And if they really are concerned about that, they can opt out, but it will not be buried in a 25-page document. It will be a letter, and it will be very clear to the account owner the limitations of what we plan to do.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you. So, but to be clear, you are going to change the privacy policy to capture and share that data, and they only get an opt-out. They don't opt into this program.
That's correct.
Thank you. No further questions. Thank you.
All right. I don't see any other questions. The discussion today has been really good, and I think some helpful suggestions have been made. Chair Bernardi, did you want to make any closing statements?
Thank you, members, for the thoughtful questions and answers today. I really appreciate that. And moving forward, let's look into seeing how we can address these, and that we will work with the Office of Higher Education and the members who have had these questions. We appreciate your thoughtfulness and appreciate your support moving this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks again to our testifiers today. With that, I renew my motion that House File 1636, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Higher Education Committee, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker-Finn. Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier. Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Absolutely not.
Nay. Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen. Excuse. Representative Novotny.
No.
Representative Farr.
No.
Representative Robbins.
No.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
And Representative Sean.
Aye.
Great. And Representative Frazier, we couldn't hear you last time.
Aye.
Perfect. And Chair Becker-Finn. Perfect. I believe that makes four, 9 ayes and 5 nays.
There being 9 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 1636, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Higher Education Committee.
Chair Mueller, it's 5 nays, I believe.
Oh, okay. Let's say that again. So there were 9 ayes and 5 nays. The motion prevails. House File 1636, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Higher Education Committee. Representative Scott, I see that your hand is up.
Yes, Madam Chair. And I was just wanting to ask the bill's author before we part ways here this morning, if they do make these changes, if this bill would be coming back to our committee so we could take another look at it.
Representative Bernardi?
Right now, that's not the plan, but we can look into that and get back to you on that.
All right, sounds good. We don't have any other bills on our agenda. Our next hearing, members, is Monday the 8th at 5 p.m. The agenda is posted on our committee webpage. Have a great weekend, everybody. This meeting is adjourned.